All right, good evening, Aerosols. Let us open with our blessing before the study of Torah. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher kirishanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu le'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and has commanded us to immerse ourselves in the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. Okay, somewhere floating around, I think, is a sign-up sheet for the ladies interested in going to Memphis in February to see Rebetz and Hannah, about if you need a hotel room there and other information. If you want more information, you can speak with my wife, Tricia, after class, or email me, and we'll get that to you. So that should be somewhere floating around, or will be soon. Okay. Well, welcome back. Are you hungry for Torah?
Yes.
Your 3-week break there, or somewhere around there? Well, to celebrate that, I thought we'd have a little fun before we got into our lesson. Seems many of you enjoy the Sunday School Mythbusters, and we've learned Jacob and Esau weren't little young whippersnappers when they deceived Isaac, but they were senior citizens, and Moses didn't hold up tablets, he held up cubes, and other little tidbits we found. Now, some people don't like having their Sunday School myths busted, and but I think you guys are mature enough for that, to handle that. So let's review a little bit as we get into this this myth bust. Remember when we studied the Nazarite vow in the Torah? Okay, what was a Nazarite? Tell me what you remember about a Nazarite.
Don't touch hair, no wine,
no fruit of the vine. What else about their diet? Did what is about their diet? What don't they eat?
Pork.
Well, we have pork. You don't have to take a Nazarite vow not to eat pork. They are kosher, but they're almost super kosher, okay? What else? They don't eat. They don't eat meat. Okay, they're vegetarians. Okay. So, keeping this in mind, we turn in our Gospels, and remember we looked at some Nazarites in the New Testament. Remember Paul took a Nazarite vow for a while, then went to make sacrifices at the temple. Remember from the Torah, what's one of the sacrifices you make for a Nazarite vow? A sin offering. Paul offered sin offerings at the temples 30 years after the resurrection. Remember, we thought about that for a little bit. Luke chapter 1 tells us about another lifelong Nazarite. Who's that?
John the Baptist.
Yeah, before he's born, you get some prophecies about John the Baptist. And one, I think it's around somewhere in Luke chapter 1, it's the prophecy that he'll be a Nazarite. Okay? So that means he's a vegetarian. I just assuming he obeys the Torah. Okay? What's the problem with that? What's his diet consist of? Does it really consist? Consists of locusts and honey.
No, there's something to that.
There's a lot to that. We're going to, though, undo some of this. The word in the Greek New Testament for locust that John eats is akris. A-K-R-I-S would be a transliteration. Want to know a funny little thing about akris? It doesn't really necessarily refer to the little grasshopper like locust.
Sounds like a spider.
No? You go to Israel, it is all, they're all over the place. There's these trees called carob trees. And in fact, the locals call them locust trees. And their fruit is called locust. The little pods that come off are called locusts. And this is especially true in the Greek language. The Greek culture in particular always called this the carob tree locust. Okay, so another tidbit. Do you know another name that these locusts have become known as for 15, 16, 1700 years? John's bread. How did they get that nickname? Okay, so I'm going to show you a little picture up here. Hopefully they'll still be there. There's a carob tree. Okay, and you see those all over Israel. And then in a few seconds we'll see the locusts. That's a dried one, and that's a fresh one. If you've been to Israel, you stepped on those the whole time there. Okay, they're everywhere. Okay. St. John's bread. This is the locust, John 8. Can you thank your King James Bible for you thinking it's grasshoppers? Okay.
Was he really close to the bird, though?
Yes. Oh, yes. Now, in modern-day Israel, this is used as a substitute for chocolate. In fact, when you take the trip of your lifetime with the Hannigans this October, when you go to Israel with them, you're out in the field. Ruth Ann or David's going to stop you and say, "Okay, here's the locust tree, and here's some locusts." And you're going to open it up, and you're going to eat a pod out of it. And get someone to take your picture. And then when you go to the hotel that evening, you're going to have some cake. They're always at it. It's going to have carob in it. Just make sure you eat it and get real messy in your teens and smile and get a picture taken. And then when you go to your bedroom or your hotel room that evening and you're ready to update your Facebook status, you say, "I was in the Judean wilderness today, and I felt akin to John the Baptist, so I ate locusts and locust cake." Okay. So, as times you've heard sermons, I can vividly remember sermons talking about John was cleaning out the legs between his teeth of the grasshoppers and all of that. Now you'll know. They don't know what acris means. Acris is this. This is the locust. John never ate meat. The Gospels tell us that. Okay. So, little fun myth-buster for you. Another little tidbit about it. The inside of the carob are often called pods. And they're notorious for not only being the food for the poor, because they're everywhere and they're nutritional and so forth, but they were also the food you fed the pigs. So this is the prodigal son's, what he is craving to eat, the pods. Okay? So, little information there for you. John the Baptist did eat locusts, but locust is the name of a fruit. Okay, so a little fun there with you. And that fits the record. If he was truly a Nazarene, as what he was prophesied, he wouldn't have been munching on locusts, the grasshopper bread.
The honey?
What's that?
Honey
yes and no. Honey is always Torah. Always Torah.
It's always what?
It's always Torah.
Torah.
But it's also honey. Okay, let's get into our lesson here, weekly Hebrew lesson. Doing Parashat Shelach this evening. That starts in Numbers chapter 13 and goes through Numbers chapter 15. Our Hebrew lesson this week is Numbers chapter 13, verse 1, and the first part of verse 2. Now, for those who are new with us, joining us, don't worry about the Hebrew lesson. Those who've been with us a while, they'll tell you that they didn't know what was going on with the Hebrew lesson at first, and now they'll tell you they can translate that whole first verse with no problem. The best way to learn it is just to be around it, immerse yourself, hear it, and pick up the little tidbits I give you. Hebrew goes right to left, so you're going to start over there on the right with the word that looks like this. I have it color-coded. Okay. Pronounce that vaydaver. Hebrew kind of crams things together. So we have the Hebrew letter vav, That's the very first word. Vav in Hebrew is the coordinating conjunction, and. Then we have the Hebrew letter Yod. Yod, when it's in front of a verb, lets us know that it is third person, masculine, singular. So it is a he did, kind of he blank verb. He, she, it kind of thing. Okay? And then Daber, the three-letter root that lets you know what the verb actually is. And Daber means to speak. But Daber means a little more than to speak because it always implies some kind of divine aspect to this communication. And this gets translated into the Greek as logos, the word of John 1. That goes back into the Hebrew of Daber. So it has a divine communication aspect. There's a different Hebrew word for just kind of generic, I said to you. So Vaidaber means, and he spoke, or and he said, or and he communicated. Hebrew likes to go verb, then subject. Our language, we go subject, verb. Hebrew can do that, but it typically goes verb, subject. So we got our verb, and now we're looking for the subject. Is the subject going to remain he, or will we find a subject following it? So, Vaidaber Adonai. Adonai, that's the proper name for the Lord. That's the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D in your English Bibles. So that's our subject. Vaidaber Adonai. So the Lord spoke, or the Lord speaks, the Lord communicates. El Moshe. El is the preposition to Moshe. Is Moses. So when the Lord speaks to Moses, Lemor. Okay, Lemor is kind of an infinitive, but it just means saying. Okay, saying. And then you can put your quotes. Okay, so that's the first verse of chapter 13. Vaidaber Adonai Moshe Lemor. Okay, the Lord communicates to Moses saying. And then what's he say? He says, Shelach Lecha. Now this is, we're going to spend our first section looking at the importance of this. Shelach is an imperative from Shelach. It means to send out. So it literally means you send out, because it's imperative is second person. You send out. And then Lecha is you, to you. So it's got this double emphasis. It's a very odd structure. Now for those who've been with us a while, do you remember when we were in Genesis and we had a parashat named Lake Lecha? And we talked about that meant to you, to go to you. You know, and we kind of explored that. That's on the website if you want to listen to that lecture around Genesis 12, 13, 14, Lake Lecha. This is the same kind of construction. It's repetitive and it's odd. You send out, you send out. You send out you. Okay, and so our Hebraic minds say when we're reading our Torah and you come across a really bizarre statement, a bizarre structure, doesn't just mean that Moses was trying to be creative writing, that he didn't want to write the same way every time, he didn't want his teacher to give him a B for, you know, repeating the same phrases, so he's trying to spice it up. What's it mean? If you're thinking like in Hebrew.
Pay attention.
You got to really explore this. Okay, this is really worth exploring. And that's actually what we are about to do. Shelach Lecha. You notice that's the name of the parashat. Parashat Shelach. The Torah is divided up into 54 parashats. And each one of them is named after the, one of the first distinguishable words that's not common. Hence, we can't name this parashat Vaidaber because how many parashats do we have named Vaidaber? Okay, a lot, right? Okay, so Shelach. Shelach Lecha. Very important to find out what that grammatical structure really is about. Okay. So let's talk about it here. Choice. The father finally allows the children to act of their own accord. So in this parashat, it covers, one of the chief things it covers is the sending out of the 12 spies to the land of Canaan. Okay, they've moved along, and they send out some spies to check out the potential promised land. So on whose initiative were the spies sent out? The way the story is told in Numbers 13 from our parashah, it's divine. Numbers 13, verses 1 and 2. And Adonai spoke to Moshe, saying, You send men, that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm going to give the children of Israel. One man. So that they're repeated. Per tribe shall you send each a prince among them. However, 40 years later, when Moses is getting old and realizes, I'm not going to make it with you guys. He's getting Joshua primed. So he goes through the whole story of everything with the children of Israel one more time. And when he recounts this, he says it's the people of Israel who had the initiative to send out the spies. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 22 and 23. And you all approached me and said, let us send men before us, that they may search out the land and bring us back word regarding the road by which we shall go up and the cities we shall enter. And this thing was favorable in my eyes. And so I took 12 men from among you, one per man per tribe. Now, is this the proof we skeptics need to prove that the Bible is inconsistent with itself? That it contradicts itself? Well, actually, if you're a Hellenistic Greek philosopher, yeah, this is exactly what you need. Because the Western mind, this is a contradiction. But you learn to think Hebraically. Is it man's initiative? Or is it Hashem's initiative?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Important dialectic we've been learning. The Torah often presents two seemingly contradictory statements or propositions or actions, something that creates a tension between them. Where our Western mind wants to say, well, it's got to be either or. It's got to be one of those. Which one is it? The Hebrew mind says, well, both of these are true, so what I have to do is I have to find out what's the third thing that brings all of this into one cohesive reality. Okay, that is key Hebraic Eastern way of reading your Bible. Very not Western. Okay, and so we have here, God sends them out. We have here Moses saying, you guys came to me and I decided to do this. How do we resolve this? The answer is in Shelach Lecha. Okay? The sages reconcile these two accounts of the sending of the spies by explaining that the initiative indeed did come from the people of Israel. But let's keep going here. Rashi, if you have a Kumash in that section underneath that long black line, all in commentary, most of that's by Rashi. He's recording for you. Rashi is a Peshat guy, meaning he only is looking at the grammar of the text, only the plain literal meaning. And so he's really, as a Hebrew grammarian, is going to unpack some of these things. He translates the verse like this. Moses then consulted with Adonai, Hashem, who said to him, you send, you men. That's a good translation, isn't it? That's why your English Bibles don't translate it that way. What it's implying is, send them as dictated by your own understanding, because I am not going to tell you what to do. Shelach Lecha literally means this in the Hebrew. It's an idiom. It means do as you see fit. Shelach Lecha means do as you see fit. So the spy's mission, while it certainly receives divine consent, has a divine component. The divine component of it is you handle it. Okay? The divine component is you handle it. Now this is a significant thing going on in the Torah. Okay? The result is a tragic setback in the history of God's people. because the spies, they bring back a demoralizing report. They cause most of the people to lose faith in God's promise that the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, that was their eternal heritage. And the entire generation was then deemed unfit to inherit the land, ages 20 to 60. And it was decreed that they would live out their lives in the desert. Only 40 years later does Moses' successor Joshua lead a new generation across the Jordan River into the promised land. Joshua and who's the other one?
Caleb.
They were the only two spies to speak in favor of the conquering land. And so they're the only two of that generation to enter the land. But here's an important point. There are a couple of, there are watershed moments throughout the Torah and throughout the Tanakh. For instance, a watershed moment comes in 2 Samuel 7. Up until that point, everything's been focused on the seed, on the descendant of Abraham. But in 2 Samuel, it shifts to the king and the son of David. And monarchy, and metaphors shift from being seed metaphors to being monarchy metaphors and so forth. Watershed, big watershed. This is a watershed moment in the Torah. Because up until this point, God had imparted specific directives to Moses and the people of Israel literally every single step of the way. I mean, everything they did was laid out for them, right? When they ate, what they ate, what they drank, when they went, when even back in Egypt, when the plagues were going on, everything was completely spelled out for them. The case of the spies is the first instance. And remember, what's important in Torah study? First of anything, right? This is the first instance in which God is saying, I am not going to tell you what to do. Shelach lecha. You do as you see fit. Now, should this not have set off a warning light in the mind of Moses? Actually, it did. The sages tell us that Moses sent off Joshua with the blessing, may God deliver you from the conspiracy of the spies. That's some of the commentary there. So why did Moses send them? And if for whatever reason he thought it necessary to send them, why doesn't Moses at least bless them? Why does he only bless Joshua? Why does he bless all of them? Even more amazing is the fact that a generation later, as the children of Israel again are ready to enter the land for the second time, guess what Joshua does? He sends out spies. Really? Boy, man, can you say fractal, right? But this time it works out fine. But again, why did he initiate a process which had ended so tragically in the past? Now, obviously, Moses was well aware of the risk involved when embarking on a course of do as you see fit. For man to strike out on his own without precise instructions from on high, and with only his finite and subjective judgment as his compass, that is to enter a minefield strewn with possibilities for error and failure. Yet Moses also knew that God was opening up a completely new arena of human potential. This is a completely new period for God's people to elevate to a new level. A most crucial element of our mission in life is the element of choice. Were God to have created man as a creature who could never do any wrong, he might as well have just not created the world at all. The entire point of God's desire in creation is that there exists a non-perfected world and that we, by our choice, become part of the process to perfect it. Remember, that was a big thing we did for those who with us who did Bereshit Genesis. That God, his reason we don't know, but we do know he created us to be part of the process. Part of the process. Part of the process of bringing the Messiah, part of the process of ushering in paradise. He created a non-perfect world on purpose. The fall was not an accident. Really, the Almighty, All-Powerful, Sovereign, Omnipotent, fill in all your superlative adjectives, really didn't know? Of course he knew. It's all part of it. It's all part of the process. It's part of the process so that we can participate in its perfection. And it's precisely the possibility for error on our part that lends significance to our achievement. And that's also what makes our relationship with God legitimate. Okay, I want you to think about, God wants to have a relationship with you. What do we call it when a man says he wants to have a relationship with a woman? And he doesn't care if she wants the relationship or not. She's going to love him whether she wants to love him or not. And he forces the relationship.
One-sided.
I mean, we call that the worst. We call it rape. It's not a relationship and it's not love. What is a real relationship?
Consensual.
It's consensual. And so for our relationship to God to be genuine, it has to be consensual. And in order for it to be consensual, what does God have to leave open? The possibility that we would reject Him. Okay. So, choice is a crucial element in our mission of life because we are to be part of the process, but we're to be willful participants. Now, the concept of choice exists on two levels. When God issues an explicit instruction to us, we still have the choice to defy His command, as is proof in our everyday life, right? Now this, however, is a choice in a more limited sense. For in essence, our soul is literally a part of God above. If we take serious idea that we're created in God's image, now we've talked about that before when we were in that section of Genesis. What does that really mean? Doesn't mean we look like God, so it doesn't mean image that way. God's without body and all of that stuff. So, created in God's image, what does that mean? There's an aspect within us that is directly connected to God. And so, there's a part of us that always wants to go back and connect to God. Now, sometimes people don't understand what's that desire that's pushing them and all of that, and they direct it in all kinds of crazy ways. As C.S. Lewis said, there's no such thing as an atheist, and that's absolutely true. You can give me Richard Dawkins. He's no atheist. You better believe he believes in science way more than you probably believe in God. Okay, he has a God. Everybody has something. They're always trying to connect to something beyond themselves. It's because there's something in us. We want to fulfill the divine will. So in reality, the only choice we actually have is this. Whether or not we suppress that innate will that's already in us to connect to God. It's not about if we choose God or reject God. It's do we suppress what's already instilled in us. Now up until the episode of the spies, this was the only choice offered to God's people. God provided unequivocal guidelines for each and every issue that confronted their lives. We spent a lot of time in Leviticus looking at that. And they had the choice, seemingly, to disobey. But to do so would run contrary to their deeper instincts. The second level of choice is what was introduced with God's reply to Moses in that Shalach Lecha. When Moses heard God saying, "Do as you see fit," he understood God was opening up another even deeper and truer dimension of choice in the life of humanity. By creating an area in which He, the Creator and absolute Master of the world, says, "I'm not going to tell you what to do," God was imparting an even greater significance to human actions. Think of it even as a parent. You have a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, you can govern their life. Do they really choose if they're going to go to school or not? Most of the time, hopefully, no, right? Do they really get to eat, you know, popcorn and Airhead candy for supper every night? Again, hopefully not. They really get to say, "I'm not going to the dentist." You govern everything in their life. On a smaller scale, they get some choices here and there and everything like that. But not really. But there comes a point, what? Again, theoretically and hopefully, where you say, "You know what? It's time to see fly. See what you can do with what I've imparted to you." This is, and that's a deeper level of maturity, right? Now, again, the risk is they can really, really mess it up, right? They can really make some bad choices. Or they can elevate and become very mature people. This is what's going on here. Okay, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Here and only here is the choice truly real. Here and only here is there nothing to compel us in either direction. When we enter this arena, as I said, the risks are greater. The possibility to err is greater. The consequence of our error is more devastating. But likewise, when we succeed in discovering, without mere empowerment from above, magically guiding us everywhere, then the optimal manner in which to enter the Holy Land is to actualize the divine will that's inside of us. And then the deeds that we do are infinitely more valuable and significant. God wants them to enter the Holy Land because they want to enter the Holy Land. Doesn't want them to enter the Holy Land because he keeps magically parting waters, he keeps magically defeating enemies. He wants them to enter because they want to and because they fully believe they have the right to do it. This was why Moses dispatched the spies. And that's why this is the reality of how it's God and man. Really, it's still God. God's the one that's got to say, you do as you see fit. And that's got a divine purpose behind it. It's also man. And so Moses dispatches the spies, fully aware of the hazards of their mission, without so much as a blessing that they be safeguarded from the pitfalls of their human endeavor. Were he to have blessed them, to have imparted them of his own spiritual prowess to succeed in their mission, he would have undermined the uniqueness of the opportunity that God had granted to them by consenting that their mission be by their own understanding. So the entire point was that both Moses, in deciding whether to send them, and the spies in executing their mission, would entirely be it on their own, guided and empowered by their own understanding and humanity, and still not forsake their God. Was that whole time of the plagues and coming out, all that time of getting them ready, remember the 50 days, you can take the Hebrew out of Egypt, but it takes a long time to get the Egypt out of the Hebrew, on all those testings, the things we discussed when we were in the book of Exodus, getting them ready to beat his people. He's now saying, I've raised you. Let's see if it's stuck. Okay. Watershed moment. Okay. Let's keep talking about this a little more. Holy espionage, Batman. Okay. They're not really spies. Naughty translation again, folks. Naughty translation of those King James people that were so afraid to change that translation. Because you then won't buy it. Parashat Shalach begins with Moshe Rabbeinu, that is Moses our teacher, preparing God's people for their entrance in the promised land, the land of Israel. God's original plan was that the exodus from Egypt would be completed in essentially three stages. First, the Egyptians would be drowned in the Red Sea. The people would then come to Mount Sinai, where they would purge themselves of the Egypt, receive the Torah, and then they would enter the land of Israel, with Moses leading the way and immediately making their way to Mount Moriah, where there they would not have constructed a tabernacle, but the temple. But as we know, this was not what happened. After an entire year at Mount Sinai, the people were now finally on the eve of entering the land of Israel. Without the land of Israel, the Torah could not become a way of life, and the children of Israel would not be able to spread that light to the entire world. So as part of the preparations, the Torah relates that Moses sent 12 spies to survey the land of Israel. And as we've talked about, we know their mission fails. However, if we carefully read the text, we can actually see that through the mission, though the mission contained an element of, what's the fancy word for a spy? Reconnaissance? Oh, yeah. It had a little bit of that in it. Its main goal was not espionage in that classic sense. Moshe sent the 12 men, all were leaders of their tribe, princes, they were to prepare the land. That's actually what the text says. They were to prepare the land for the coming of the people. Okay, we're going to keep unpacking that. That's an important phrase, but that's what the Torah in the Hebrew actually says. They are to go there to prepare the land for their arrival. At that time, the land of Israel was still the land of Canaan. It was inhabited by 7 Canaanite nations. That's important. 7 is not only a number of perfection, but it's also a number that symbolizes the nations. And so you have 7 Noahide laws and so forth. And they had pretty abominable practices and traditions, religiously and morally. Since the time of Noah, the land had been filled with these abominations, and the spies were entrusted with the mission of preparing it as a home for the holiness of God's people and the holiness of God. The image reflecting this preparation is that of a farmer plowing his land in preparation for sowing. Now, if we look at the root word for the Hebrew word that does mean spy, that's mergal, M-E-R-G-A-L. It stems from the root to tread or to walk. But you know what? Either as a noun or a verb, that word for spy does not appear in this entire parashat in any form whatsoever. And that's the Hebrew word, including the biblical Hebrew word, for spy. There's no biblical Hebrew word for spy, spying, spies in this parashah. The verb and nouns used to describe the mission given to the so-called spies is letur, L-E-C-U-R. And it means to survey. The verb to survey appears 10 times in this parashah, actually 10 times in this opening chapter. And one more at the end of the parashat when it talks about the tzitzit. The distinction between spying and surveying is the point here. And it's quite clear, and again, it seems to stress that Moses was not focusing on collecting intelligence. But still, when reading the sage's explanation of events, Moses' emissaries, they're referred to as spies. Even Rashi talks about that a little bit. So how did all the sages of the people who've gone before us handle that they really aren't called spies? Because they picked up on this fact. The Baal Shem Tov says that when a person finds himself walking in a particular place, it's not by chance. Nothing is by chance. Fundamental teaching of Hebraic worldview. Nothing is by chance. Absolutely nothing. Every person you meet, every person you stand behind in line at Kroger, every cashier you encounter, every look you see across while you're eating your Big Mac, everything is by divine providence to teach you something. The fact that we are so aloof and don't pay attention is our problem, that we don't see the divine in everything. But if we take this seriously, that wherever we find ourselves walking, it's not by chance. That divine providence has brought that person there, and all for the purpose so that person can shine a light there. This is starting with some bells and teachings of Yeshua. The idea is that wherever you are at, you are to shine a light and release the divine sparks that are there. So if you think of creation, before the fall, as a mirror, a nice, beautiful, shiny, polished, perfect mirror, reflecting to us the image of God. The fall is fracturing it. And so all these little shards of divine light and reflection fall all over the place, like a mirror, you know, or if you drop a glass in your kitchen and it shatters everywhere. Theoretically, you could put it back together. That's the process of tikkun. So, this divine light is everywhere. The Hebraic mind says, wherever you are at, you are to find the broken shard that's there and come and put it back. Redeem it. Shine the light so that it can either repent, so that it can be sanctified again. It's being used incorrectly, so it can be used for the correct purpose. Whatever the situation, scenario, you're there to find the divine shard in it. And you're to take that shine the light of Yeshua, the light of the Messiah, unto that, and then bring it back, so that little by little things get ready for the coming of the Mashiach. Okay? So as followers of Yeshua, we are emissaries of the Almighty. And thus, by our mere presence, we are called to illuminate the surroundings around us with the divine presence we know. And you can think of the passages in John where Yeshua is urging people to be lights. The purpose behind this is that the divine light acts like a magnet. It awakens any sparks of holiness present in its surrounding and draws them closer. In other words, wherever you find yourself, if you turn on your light, think about a hot, sticky, humid evening in Louisiana on the porch drinking some sweet tea and getting those mosquitoes so you get you a nice, bright blue light. What happens? All the bugs draw to it. Since every person has a shattered shard in them, if you will, this is a metaphor, okay? So if we can grasp the concept, has a shattered shard in it. Everything, every place has a shattered shard in it. If you shine the light there, what happens? What should happen? All that's got the shards around it should draw it to itself. And so you elevate it. So Canaan, it's got prostitution, cult sacrifice, all these horrible things, but yet it's also holy. All the way back to when Abraham, you know, went to Mount Moriah, right there in the land of Canaan, swung to offer up his son. All the things that happened there, holiness. But all of a sudden, this nice covering of darkness is over. So the spies weren't to go gather information. They were to go to prepare the land. How did they go prepare the land? By bringing out the holiness there. To bring out the sparks. Okay? This is actually what the text is describing as their mission. Okay? So, the 12 spies, representing the 12 tribes of Israel, circled the borders of the land, entrusted with the mission of awakening the holiness that's there, the sparks that are there, that have been in exile since the land had been so corrupted by the Canaanites. And later, when the people would enter the land en masse, these awakened sparks would have been revealed in full, proclaiming, as it were, their bond with the Almighty, His chosen people. So the sages relate that had the spies been true to their mission and reported back in earnest, describing what they had seen as surveyors, and not interpreting information in terms of war tactics, as spies do, then no battle would have been fought to conquer the land of Israel. Famous saying in Judaism, even dates before the time of Yeshua, Mashiach comes, the world will be his without the firing of a bullet or the shooting of an arrow, if you want to go back to different metaphors that's been used. No war will happen because of the light. And the idea was that the Canaanites, as pagan and as disgusting as they were what? They were nature worshippers, right? Mm-hmm. They would have been so in touch with that aspect, though perverted, they would have been drawn to the light, and they would have given the land to Israel. They would have picked up and left. But the spies instead preferred to drown the enthusiasm for entering the land, and so they decided to act like spies. That's when they ended up getting called spies. Because that's actually what they ended up doing. That wasn't their mission. So the lesson to be learned and meditated upon from Parashat Shelach is that it is up to us to rectify the sins of the spies by sending ourselves out as holy surveyors, holy emissaries of Yeshua, to enlighten our surroundings and prepare them for the revelation of the divine. By the way, have you ever heard of this term, for those who studied the roots long enough, a minion? What's a minion? Quorum of 10 men. in order to have a congregation, you need 10. And this is actually in some even Christian congregations, they'll have, oh, I should have 10 elders, 10 deacons, 10 leaders, and so forth. This originated as a way of rectifying the 10 spies, their sin, to try to bring out the light of holiness that was there. That's when that became the necessary building credential for any official quorum in Judaism, as from the spies. So wherever life takes us, our role and mission is to make the place in which we find ourselves a vessel for godliness, to be lights for the Messiah. This principle applies not only in the land of Israel, but everywhere on earth. Once when he was asked about this, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe said, "Make the place where you are at the land of Israel." Rebbe Nachman once said, or actually said many times, in fact it's a nice little melody, "Everywhere I walk, I'm walking in the land of Israel." Same principle. So in the future, the holiness of the land of Israel said that it will spread outside its borders and encompass the whole world. You can read that in the prophets. Certainly the first revelation of this expansion of the borders of holiness begins with spirituality invested by us wherever we live. Okay, so they weren't to be spies. They were to be surveyors. The Hebrew word is not spy. And the Hebrew says that their mission was to prepare the land for the arrival of the people. The drink offering. Many people in the world look on us as followers of Yeshua as fools, wasting our time with religion. On some occasions, we actually may ourselves feel as if we are fools, that our efforts to serve God have been in vain. It might seem as if we have wasted our time, our energy, in pursuing the things of God and His kingdom. But in the Torah, we learn that which is wasted on God is not a waste at all, but a service that is received at the altar of heaven. And so in this parashat in Numbers chapter 15, the first 12 verses, it talks about the wine libations or the drink offerings. This was what the priesthood was to pour over God's altar. No one drank the wine libations. They were completely poured out, all of it. To some, this may have seemed like a waste, right? Why waste all that wine? Kind of like, why waste all that perfume on his feet? Rav Shaul, or the Apostle Paul, compared his own life to a wine libation being poured out over the altar on two different occasions. He did so early in his life, or early in his career, to the Philippians, and the other at the end of his life in 2 Timothy. To the Philippians, Paul compares his life to a drink offering, and that he has poured out his efforts upon the Philippians without any assurance of success. Some would measure his efforts spent on them to be a waste, but instead Shaul sees it as a gesture of worship. He says, "Upon the sacrifice and service of faith," Philippians 2, 17 and 18. "But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering." Now, was Paul a drink offering? Was he a replacement for the drink offering? What is he doing by saying this? He's just drawing the analogy, right? Just always keep that running in your head. He says, "But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and the service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me." Years later, near the end of his life, he wrote to Timothy. He knew that he wasn't going to survive the intrigue of the court of Nero. And so again, he compares his life to a drink offering, the one that's discussed in our parashat, as being poured over the altar. He knew he was going to die the martyr's death, but in perspective, it was a noble end in as much as his martyrdom was for the sake of the kingdom. So in the same way, the wine of libation, it was wasted, if you will, on the altar, but it was not wasted at all because it was rendered as a holy service to God. the idea of as below, so above. So when a mitzvah, which doesn't mean commandment, it means connection. So they're not 10 commandments, they're 10 connections. So there's no such thing as being a legalist unless connecting to God is a bad thing. Okay. When you do one below, it connects you to above. And so when they would do the wine libation, when they would supposedly waste all of that good expensive wine and just pour it over the altar and then trip on the ground, it made a connection above, which then resulted in an action from above that came back down. That's what a commandment is. It's not about do's and don'ts. It's about connecting to God. It's about connecting to God. It is, you know, it isn't about earning God's favor. It isn't about earning salvation. It's about connection. Okay? So when they would do these wine libations, it rendered a holy service. And so Paul was saying that that's sort of the way he viewed his life. That many people would say he was wasting his life doing these things. But he saw it as doing a holy service, connecting to above, reverberating below. So it wasn't a waste. So he writes in 2 Timothy 4:6, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come." Yeshua himself, on taking the cup of his last Seder meal, makes allusion to the drink offering ritual. By the way, what's commonly called the Last Supper, while it is at a Passover Seder, Yeshua actually incorporates the language from all five of the major offerings, as well as all of these other offerings. And so that's why the order is different and all. It's not because people messed with the text and all that. One, you can't prove people messed with the text. So when people usually say that, it's because they believe something different and they can't prove it, so they say somebody changed the text. And they conveniently reconstructure a text that doesn't exist and say that was the original, and it happens to be exactly what I believe. Instead, if you carefully read the language, he's encapsulating an entire system, not just one of it. And he brings in the wine libation when he says, "This cup," in Luke 22, "is poured out for you." That has nothing to do with any Seder. The wine libation. "This cup is poured out for you. It is the new covenant in my blood." Mark 14:24, "This blood is poured out for many." Matthew 26, he adds, "This is poured out for the forgiveness of sins." So he's saying his upcoming martyrdom, his death, is like a wine libation offering. It may seem wasteful. What a waste of a life. He runs his mouth that he's the Son of God and he's the Messiah and he's all of these things. He could have been a brilliant mind if he had just kind of kept his mouth shut. He could have done a lot more if he'd worked within the system. But instead, he's getting crucified at age 33. What a waste. And so he uses the image of "I'm being poured out" to say it isn't a waste. It isn't a waste at all. And by the way, often, you know, it's said, well, in Kiddush and in the Seder, wine comes before bread, and there it's the reverse. Guess what? There's an offering in the Torah where the bread comes first. So nobody had to mess with the text. You just got to make sure you make all the connections. And so the Master's blood, which was poured out on the ground like water and like a drink offering upon the altar, was no waste. Now, did he replace the libation? No. That's not what it's about. Okay, he's drawing the images. Okay, the complainer. We've come to our weekly midrash. What is a midrash? Yeah, we have the four levels. The Torah. The Peshat. Orgamez. Drash. And then Sod forms the acronym Pardes, which is the Hebrew word for orchard, paradise. Shad is the literal, plain understanding. This is where we're comfortable in the West and in the church. Means what it says what it means. Grammar, historical context, all of those kinds of things. And by the way, the Shad is always true and always has to be true. It can never be, no level can remove or contradict the previous. Memez means hint. It's what's hinted at in the text. So again, you know, I usually use a proverb. Proverbs are written in Remez. Proverbs talks about don't have an unbalanced scale. Okay, so I don't own a scale, so that proverb doesn't apply to me. Well, no, it kind of hints to fairness, right? How to treat people in business interactions. So it hints to something beyond itself. Darash, that is homiletic, sermon, moral, ethical. Parables are a key way of doing a darash, trying to give a spiritual meaning to an earthly story, if you will. You try to pull the moral nugget, the moral application out. And so it is the more deeper, advanced, esoteric, mysterious kind of reading. Mark is a Peshat Gospel, Luke is a Remez Gospel, Matthew is a Darash Gospel, John is a Sod Gospel. Okay, each of these has their own rules. There's 7 rules for this one. I've gone through Mark and I've found how Yeshua and all his arguments uses all 7 of these rules. Remez has 13 rules. Some of them obviously overlap. 32 and 42. Okay. So they aren't just willy-nilly. So usually each week I try to take the text and compile a midrash for you. The Talmud in Tractate Arichin 15 says, when it's commenting on the story of the 10 spies and their evil report, it says this: one who spreads an evil report, it's as if he has denied the existence of God. And that's what we're going to kind of take our launching point off of here. From our parashat, Numbers 14:27, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I've heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. So the spies, they returned from Canaan with a big cluster of grapes. The grapes should have encouraged the Israelites. Why should it have encouraged them?
Because the fruit of the land.
Yeah, this means, you know, this is a good land. It's full of bounty. It's just as God had promised. The 10 spies, however, interpreted the giant grapes differently. They used them as evidence that it was inhabited by unconquerable giants. What would you expect from the vineyard of giants? So isn't it strange that two people can look at the same thing, such as a cluster of grapes, and come to two opposite conclusions? To Joshua and Caleb, the giant grapes were a great thing. This is awesome. To the other spies, the grapes were a sign of despair. And so God said he heard the grumbling and the complaints of the children of Israel. And you know what? He hears our complaints too. The sin of grumbling is related to the sin of gossip. Both are forms of Lashon Hara, your favorite word. Because they both result from a critical spirit. Gossip destroys others, breaks up friendships, severs relationships. Grumbling destroys your quality of life as well as those around you. So I want you to imagine you're going to a zoo with a cranky, undisciplined 5-year-old. And it's not my son. And you take the child to see the lions, but he's sulking because you didn't buy him any candy. You take him to see the zebras, but he's angry because he doesn't want to hold your hand in the large crowd. You take him to see the monkeys, but he's having a fit because he wanted french fries. So you go and buy him french fries, but he throws them away and leaves them uneaten because they're soggy. At the end of the day, he doesn't see lions, he doesn't see zebras, he doesn't see monkeys, he doesn't get candy, and he doesn't eat his french fries. He had a miserable day, and so did you. The child transformed what could have been wonderful into a horrible existence, good for nothing. As an adult, it's easy to look at a situation like that and realize how foolish and unruly the child is. It's harder to realize that our own complaints, our own grumbling, and our own murmuring Guess what, folks? It's just as petty. We're usually sophisticated enough, though, to disguise our childish tantrums and inner discontent. So we disguise them as serious adult issues, concerns, and complaints. Oh, I'm really not happy with myself and my job and how things are going, so I will get on a committee at church where I can exercise authority and make it a living hell for everyone in the congregation. That's a tantrum. Okay? We disguise them. On closer investigation, many of the spies tend to be no more than sulking over soggy French fries. The worst part is that it is not a trip to the zoo, it's our life. So if you spend it fussing and sulking, you'll never enjoy the good things God is continually doing for you. And you'll never even notice them. You'll never even notice a giant cluster of grapes was for you. So the Torah teaches that God hears all of our complaints and our negativity. And that's why the sages say this. The complainer is tantamount to an atheist. Because by his complaints, he denies the existence of God. By his complaints, he acts as if God does not hear his bitter words towards him. So something to think about. When you complain, it's as if we don't think God hears our discontent with him. You can think of it on an earthly level. You have a child, buy him a nice Christmas present, and he's well fed and clothed and everything, and then he starts complaining. They doesn't have something. How does it make you feel? Living on grateful bread. He who complains acts as if God does not hear his bitterness towards him. A different spirit. People say every cloud has its silver lining. The pessimist, he sees the cloud. The optimist sees the silver lining. But you, who have Hebraic eyes, what do you see?
Oh.
You see the cloud and the silver lining. That's right. You give thanks to God who made that cloud, provided the rain, and then clears the skies and lets the sun shine. From our parashat, Numbers 14:24. But my servant Caleb, because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring him into the land which he entered in. And his descendants shall take possession of it. So going back to that initial discussion, Caleb was one when he heard Shalach Lecha, embraced it. He's the one who, when the parents let him go, he made a wonderful life. And the parents said, wow, that's amazing. So the Lord spared the children of Israel, but he did punish them by consigning them to 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And they declared that they would never see the promised land that they had rejected. And this is the ages 20 to 60. Instead, their bodies would be buried there in the wilderness, but their children would be privileged to enter the land. Even Moses, Miriam, and Aaron were included in the doom, but only Joshua and Caleb were given permission out of that generation to enter the land. And it was because, as the text says, Caleb had a different spirit. The different spirit of Caleb is evident in his report about the land. He actually surveyed it. Mm-hmm. He and Joshua had seen the same Canaanites, the same fortifications, and the same apparent difficulties as the other spies. But they came to a completely different conclusion. The other spies saw these as obstacles, but Caleb and Joshua saw them as opportunities for God to demonstrate his glory. You may have heard someone say, hey, I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist. The inference is that if you're an optimistic person, you're not realistic. And accordingly, the only honest and correct way to view the world is to point out the deficiencies, the difficulties, and the inevitable failures. And for this supposed realist, this is the real world. Now, there's really nothing special or challenging about having this realist attitude. Anyone can point out problems. Anyone can criticize. It takes no talent to be an naysayer. Maybe you know someone who is one of these rigid realists. Such a person is usually not very realistic at all. Instead, a person like that demonstrates a marked tendency to emphasize the negative and ignore the positive and even disregard things like miracles. To that person, answers to prayers are just mere coinkydinks. Words of encouragement are quite irritating. And behind the veneer of cynicism is actually a life of dark self-absorption and self-pity. The 10 spies were these kinds of realists. They assessed the situation in terms of their own reality, and that was a faithless reality. And from that perspective, things looked dismal. A quick march back to Egypt for them was probably the best solution, because we're always more comfortable with the familiar. Even if the familiar is slavery, even if the familiar is a dysfunctional relationship, even if the familiar is being hung over and throwing up and puking our guts out, we go back to those things because we know them. These 10 spies, this was their reality. There's risk involved there. It's dangerous. Something might happen that I can't foresee. At least over here in Egypt, I know 8 months of the year I'm eating cucumbers and melon. Sure, 4 months are sheer hell, but I know what's coming. And so let's just go back to our comfortable misery instead of taking the risk and trusting God and trusting that that bounty is ours. Jacob and Caleb and Joshua were a different kind of realist. To them, reality wasn't as big as God was. And so they assessed the situation in terms of a reality that encompassed true faith. Remember, faith is not only intellectual belief, but acting on that belief. The difference between Caleb's spirit and the spirit of the 10 spies is the difference between seeing life through the eyes of faith and the eyes of faithlessness. And when I say the spies were faithless, I don't mean they didn't believe. They clearly believe the Lord of hosts. They've been through the Red Sea. They've been through the plagues. Been through all of this. They knew. They were faithless because Hebrew word for faith is emunah. And it not only means an intellectual sense like it does in the West, like I know this happened, but it means I'm willing to act on that belief. If you're not willing to act on the belief from a Hebraic point of view, you don't really believe. Yeah. The optimist says the cup is half full. The pessimist says the cup is half empty. So what would the Hebraic person say? Yeah, that's right. Person of faith with his Hebraic Torah-centered glasses gives thanks because the cup is half full, marvels that God will either make the half cup sufficient or miraculously refill the whole cup. Caleb's different spirit is something, again, we should be striving to attain. To be a person of faith is willing to step out and act. Caleb saw the same stuff, but he said, because God said it's our land, I will walk into it. I will actually do it. It's like the Indiana Jones movie where there's a great chasm, this fiery volcano pit, and they're being chased, and they got to get to the other side, and there's no bridge. And they and said, go. It's a bridge. It's an optical illusion. The bridge is there, but it's designed where it looks like there is no bridge. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Indiana Jones could say, you know, I believe you. So far, you've proven yourself to be a smart guy. I believe everything you've said, but I'm not stepping on that. That's not Amuna. It's when he actually stepped on it, you know, then he threw some dirt and you could see the optical illusion and so forth. Amuna, biblical faith, is not having to have someone throw the dirt on it. If God says it's there, it's there. That's the different spirit. All right, we've gone over. We have Kala. Do you want to hear about Kala or you want to hold off? It's a little bit about Kala. Because Kala comes up in our lecture. I even have some Kala here. Okay, Kala. Okay, in case you've ever been at a Shabbat meal and thought, these Jews just make up stuff. They just make up bread and bread. Really? No, it's a connection. It's a connection that so many people miss out on. It's commanded in the Torah. a commanded meaning, if you don't do it, you're going to hell, and if you do do it, God loves you and so he's going to save you. Remember, it's connection. So if you don't do it, guess what happens? You don't get punished. God doesn't save you. Guess what just happens? You don't connect to God in that way. You miss out on the connection. And that's your fault. But if you do it, you experience God in a way that you cannot experience any other way but by doing that mitzvah. Okay? It's not, again, about doing and don't, works righteousness. It's not about any of that stuff people get so stuck on that's so frustrating. It's about connecting. God said, you know what? There's something holy about tying bread with three strands. And by you doing it, you'll learn something about me that you won't learn by doing anything else. Now, I still love you. You're still going to be saved by grace. But you're going to miss that connection. Okay? Kala is in the Torah. It's in this parasha. Many things it is. I'll give you some of it. It's a symbol of the manna that God made that fell from the heavens to feed the Israelites when they were in the desert for 40 years after their exodus from Egypt. That's why on Friday nights, two loaves are usually set out on the table. Why are two loaves? Because, remember, God gave a double portion of manna to enable the Sabbath rest and enable him to rest from his manna production business. So let me think about this. God observes the Sabbath. Now, it is challah that is eaten rather than normal bread, because challah is both sweeter and richer. It's made with eggs as well as with wheat. It's a sweeter, tastier, kind of rich man's food, if you will, more fitting for the symbol of the manna which God provided. Its rich, sweet taste also serves to help bring sweet richness to the experience of the coming Sabbath. Now, why is it braided? You talk to 12 rabbis, you'll get 12 reasons why it's braided. Which one is right? Yeah. I'll give you some of them. It symbolizes the intertwining of the holy days with the secular days of the week, Sabbath and so forth, with Friday. So as Friday passes from the secular day into the holy day, it's this mingling. It also represents the connectedness that the Sabbath brings with its purpose for allowing time for family, friends, and the strengthening of relationships. You know, I think I guess I shouldn't admit I watch shows like Dr. Phil or Oprah. Or they apparently had this revolutionary idea that families that eat together are more functional. The children are less likely to do drugs or be rebellious and so. And so they had this brilliant idea that families should eat together. Really. That's a connection of challah, folks. That's one of those connections that you miss when you just decide. So they didn't really discover something or figure this out. We were told this a long time ago. And so it's like the braiding is like the different segments of the family and their lives and everything coming together, bringing in the unity. That's what Shabbat's supposed to do. It's supposed to bring the family and the community together, because you stop everything else and you just have time for one another. Your family, your community, all those things that are important. That's all that exists. Everything else stops for 24 hours. Also, each braid of the challah is made from three chunks of the dough. And so these three braids also symbolize some things. If you've read your Torah close enough, in Exodus we're told to remember Zechor, the Sabbath. In Deuteronomy we're told to guard the Sabbath, Shemor. And then the braiding of it symbolizes that those two are actually that same commandment being given as one word, Bedibur Echad. So if you've ever celebrated Shabbat here at Emmanuel, we sing Lakadodi in the first verse. That's what we sing. You know, Shemor v'zakur b'dibur echad. You have told us to remember and to guard in one precious word. Okay. Also, it symbolizes creation of man in the world, freedom of man during the exodus from Egypt, and the ideal of the Olam Haba, the world to come, kind of all being brought together, that Shabbat is kind of outside of time and space. And so it's kind of like a fractal of all these things coming together. Okay. Challah is usually covered below, usually with a platter or something, and it's also covered above, usually with a fancy cloth. It's covered above and below. Why do you think that is? And you know your story from the Torah. When the manna fell, what was it covered with? It was covered above and below. It was encased in dew, so that kept it fresh. And so if this represents the manna, then it's covered above and below. To again kind of symbolize that, to remind you of that. There's also a little deeper explanation. We cover the bread so that this wheat product, where wheat is, guess what, wheat is one of the seven prized foods of Israel, and the lady's going to Memphis, that's your topic, the seven foods of the land and their healing properties and so forth, so that it won't be shamed by the fact that it's not eaten before the wine is blessed, in spite of the fact that it technically has priority. This is very rabbinical, and there's deeper things going on. So it kind of personifies it like, hey, wine, I'm greater than you are. I'm a fruit of the earth. So you don't get to go first. So it kind of covers it so it doesn't see that. Now there's some, if you know soap level stuff, there's all kinds of hints there where it's really going up. Others say it's covered for a simple reason. It's unveiling remark, you know, and symbolizes the great opening up the great festival. So a lot of things go in to call up, including, you know, when the woman of the home is making it, it's a time that's dedicated for her and God. So she prays when she makes it, she blesses it, and there are other rituals that they do and so forth with the challah. So it's a very special thing. And again, just when you come across these things in Torah, these aren't things that we've been set free from because we don't want to be set free from these things. These aren't burdens. When you understand that they're connections, they're not burdens. The burden we've been set free from, and the curse that we've talked about before, the curse of the law is death. That's what we've been set free from. The curse of the law is not actually doing these things. The curse of the law is death. That's what Mashiach Yeshua set us free from. Death. So he set us free to have all of these connections in their truest sense. Okay, so these are wonderful ways to connect to God, and when it amazes me, the more I, you know, when I study counseling and so forth, studied all these things that are supposedly great ideas of family counseling, they all are Torah principles. You know, we've talked about that here before in class. What's the divorce rate in, you know, Mayor Shireen? Okay, there's something to it. It matters. It creates connections. It also is part of the unleashing of holiness. Separate. What is holiness? Separation. Guess who's not braiding challah? The world. It's separation. And therefore, it shines light. And then once light shines, people want to know about it. Want to know about it. Okay. Let us close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Noten HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.